Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're devoting today's morning show to jazz pianist Kenny Werner, who is going to be performing at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside with the Kenny Werner Trio tomorrow evening and presenting a masterclass tomorrow afternoon. To get us in the mood for today's conversation, here's a portion of his original composition called Who, which is from one of his most recent recordings on the Pirouette label, a compact disc called The Melody. That was a portion of the piece called Who by Kenny Werner, recorded by the Kenny Werner Trio on their most recent album on the Pirouette label called The Melody. Kenny Werner and his trio are going to be performing tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., at Francis Bedford Concert Hall in the Rita Talent Picken Regional Center for Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And he is also presenting a free masterclass tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Both of these events part of UW Parkside's Jazz Week. And Kenny Werner's appearance at Parkside, primarily sponsored by the Kenosha Community Foundation. Kenny Werner has been a world-class pianist and composer for over 40 years, a prolific and important artist who recently was awarded the 2010 Guggenheim Fellowship Award for his seminal work called No Beginning, No End. Kenny Werner is also renowned for a marvelous book which he wrote back in 1996 called Effortless Mastery, Liberating the Master Musician Within. He was born in Brooklyn back in 1951 and grew up on Long Island. He was initially a classically trained pianist and, as a matter of fact, entered the Manhattan School of Music as a classical piano major before he began really focusing his energies on his first love, which was improvisation. That led him to the Berklee School of Music in 1970. His studies there eventually took him to Brazil, where he was influenced by a whole host of other great musicians and helped forge the intriguing style which has been delighting audiences here and around the world for decades since. Again, Kenny Werner and his trio will be performing Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. in Francis Bedford Concert Hall. Here is a portion of the interview which I recorded with Kenny Werner. You have been doing this for a long, long time, and you got started at a relatively early age. Tell our listeners about the very first time you started pecking out music on a keyboard. Do you recall the circumstances under which that all began?
Oh, well, it's funny you say that. I don't know if you're actually referring to something I wrote about in my book, but, you know, I was 7 years old, and I went to a friend's birthday party, and at the birthday party, his father played piano. And I'd never seen the piano played live, and we were all standing around the piano mesmerized. And I remember running right home, it was just down the block, and saying, my parents, get me a piano. And they got a upright Wurlitzer rented with an option to buy if I should take to it. And as I sat down, I was immediately plunking out melodies. And I thought that's all it took. So I ran into walked into the kitchen and said to my mother, good news, Mom. I won't be needing those lessons. I just figured out how to play. So that's exactly what happened at the beginning.
You, of course, did study piano in sort of the classical vein. How long did that remain kind of a serious pleasure of yours before sort of playing in other styles began to predominate?
Actually, it was never serious and not that much of a pleasure. I was, everybody, when you take piano lessons at home, studies classical music. And my first teacher for 4 years was not serious at all. I mean, we used to look at these little books, and she would give me a piece, and, you know, I had perfect pitch, and I had pretty good memory. So I'd say to her, play it for me, and then I'd go home and play it by ear. Then I wouldn't touch it all week. I came back and played it, you know, not exactly what was written, but I don't think she could tell the difference. And I did that for 4 years and kind of hid from her the fact that I couldn't really read music that well. And my next two teachers were more serious, and it was a classical vein. So then I started going to Manhattan School of Music prep division in high school with another great classical teacher. And that's just what I thought you studied. You know, I was really, more than anything, not a jazz player, not a classical player. I was just an improviser. I synthesized everything I heard from movies or radio, and it would just become one big piano improvisation, you know. And so because I'd go to prep division, because I showed promise in that area, I was accepted as a concert piano major at Manhattan School of Music. But it took getting there to realize I had really no interest in the subject, and I never really enjoyed it. I just kind of did it. My natural thing was just to pick things out of the air and improvise. So you know, that's my early life. And the reason I came to jazz was more the fact that then I went to Berklee School of College of Music. Not even so much. I mean, of course, I had been listening to jazz. I can't say I was a big fan, but I knew I was an improviser, and I literally just heard that this Berklee College of Music, people improvise there. Hmm. So that's why I went there.
So,
and by the time I you know, in there, I started to hear all the music and all my friends, like Joe Lovano or John Cofield, you know, they were all serious jazz guys. And I succumbed to the group energy of that. And by the time I left there, that was pretty much what I was doing.
By the way, your biography mentions appearing on television at the tender age of 11. So at that point in time, was that playing classically, or was that an opportunity even at that tender age to show your stripes as an improviser?
Well, I was on several TV shows, and what happened was I had put someone had produced a single. We used to have single records back then. You know, I don't know if you're your age, but if you're, everybody at least has heard of them. And it was it went out on a little label. You can still find the picture somewhere. I have like one copy here. It's probably a good. I just keep it for posterity. But it was September Song on one side and a cha-cha on the other side. And September Song was the arrangement, sort of like Roger Williams' arrangement of Autumn Leaves. And there was a, you know, little orchestra, you know, maybe a, I don't know, 20-piece, you know, big band, really, but orchestrally. And the record didn't do anything, but it had me on certain TV shows, and I performed the single on those TV shows. And so, actually, I complained at 11. I said, you guys wrote me in too much here. I can't improvise on anything. So I have pictures of me in the studio, like, you know. And then 2 years later, I did a demo, which we never released, where I improvised much more. But what I was going to say is one of the shows was a show opposite Johnny Carson called Les Crane's Nightlife. It was one of the many attempts ABC and then, you know, CBS had to try to topple Johnny Carson, and it didn't last either. But I was on that show, and Nipsey Russell was the co-host.
Hmm.
And I used to do piano imitations. So I would do an imitation of Fats Waller. I also had an act where I'd wear a straw hat, checkered shirt, garters on my, you know, I looked like a bartender from the 1850s. And I would play what we called honky-tonk, but actually it was a very simple form of stride piano. Because that was the first thing I learned. That was what people, someone would come over to our house, a friend of my father's, that's the way he played. And although we didn't have many jazz records, we had a few Fats Waller records. So I developed that style before I even realized it was a style. So I also was on TV doing that. And so I was doing these piano imitations of different, you know, guys that had piano hits, Roger Williams, this other guy. Then I did an imitation of Skitch Henderson, and that got a big laugh because he was the band leader of the Johnny Carson show at that time. And so, you know, I did a lot of improvising. The thing that got me on the shows was this really kind of overridden single.
As you began...
Kind of a long answer there.
No, it's fascinating, though. Absolutely fascinating. So as you began to really seriously explore this notion of improvising, how did your work as in that change over time? I mean... What did you, in a sense, sort of begin to explore or learn about the art of improvisation? Or was it right from the beginning a really natural pursuit for you that you didn't, in a sense, have to really learn much about, just sort of maybe grow in confidence? I mean, what sort of evolution took place for you in terms of what kind of improvisations you did?
It was a completely natural, the latter. Answer. It was a completely natural thing. I wasn't that really aware of the art, but from the day I sat down to play the piano, it was obvious that, you know, I could play the piano. And, you know, that became a social benefit, and it also got you out of a lot of trouble in other classes. And I would just start to play, and there would be a transformation that happened almost since I first began, which I never understood. But evidently, not just the change I was feeling inside, but I was radiating something outside, and that made it a compelling thing to listen to. And only years later did I understand it in sort of a spiritual terms. When you let go and you transform yourself and you give yourself over to whatever ideas flow through your head, that radiates just another kind of vibration, you know. And I understood that a little better many years later, but it was really a natural process. I didn't take my studies seriously. I didn't practice. I wished I could practice, but I just never did. And I didn't have to confront it until I went to college, where I was with other talented people, and they were practicing, and they were into the music. So So it was a very horrible time at Manhattan School of Music, not because of the school, but because of me. And then a transforming time at Berklee as I started to make new friends that sort of welcomed me into the art form. You know, and it's not like I hadn't heard anything before, but I really wasn't giving it a lot of thought as far as art. And for that reason, you know, I thought that was a terrible liability. I felt much less of a person than the other people who were so serious into it. Later on, I started to take it as a plus, a positive, because I didn't feel overly oppressed by the art, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's still just me sitting down, putting my hands down, see what they want to play.
Hmm.
And so I think it's become a plus, you know, over time.
It sounds like you're describing a scenario in which you had a certain sort of spontaneous freedom about the way you improvised. And if you'd gone into it, in a sense, knowing more, that might have kind of curbed that sense of freedom and spontaneity.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. And for that reason, whenever I felt, you know, art interfering with this natural sense, I would just push the art away. Because my compass was this attraction to the next note. And I didn't want intellectual constructs to interfere with that. And today, I feel it's a nice mix. Of course, I'm aware of the tradition. I'm aware of the art. But I'm still letting my hands wander over the keyboard while I listen. And, you know, that I don't think there's any alternative for me to that kind of freedom. Without that freedom, if I was trying to make art, if I was saying, well, this is really the right music or that's the right music, I would be lost. I'd have no compass.
We're speaking with pianist Kenny Werner. The Kenny Werner Trio is performing at the University of Wisconsin Parkside tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. And Kenny Werner is also leading a free masterclass tomorrow afternoon beginning at 4 o'clock, which is part of UW Parkside's Jazz Week. So when you are setting about to improvise on something that already exists, that is creating some improvisation around a song maybe that everybody knows, typically how true do you try to remain to the original song? I mean, in terms of us hearing that melodic theme cleanly and without any hesitancy, versus some improvisation in which that original melody right from the start is in a sense heavily disguised, and you have to really listen carefully to even sort of trace its basic outlines. How do you tend to treat the original melody when you are improvising on it?
Well, it depends on the arrangement. You know, I don't know if you realize it, but what you said is really a two-parter. How faithfully do you, you know, go with the general song? And my answer is quite the opposite. If I can't bring something to the song that we never thought of, then I won't perform it. You know, I spent years just playing jazz tunes and do this tune and that tune. And of course, as a student, I studied them the way they go. But to get back to my own compass again, I wouldn't consider performing or recording a standard if I didn't have something completely different to bring to it. Otherwise, I figure it's been recorded, you know, hundreds of times. Why am I recording it?
What's the point?
The more well-known the tune is, the more I revel in the, and I like to call it surreal interpretation of it. You know, it could be a tune that we've always thought of in a certain way. I want to see if I can play it. I mean, I don't do this consciously, but until this happens to me, I don't consider performing the tune. Where I'm playing it and I say, this is really putting out a whole nother impression using that song as a vehicle. You know, Bill Evans called the tunes vehicles. And, you know, there's different schools of thought. Some people think, you know, you have to, you know, if you're playing Monk, you have to play it like Monk, or Duke Ellington, you know, you have to be faithful to it. My answer to that is, if they wanted every note to be in the right way, they should have written the whole thing out. You know, every tune is one page. The rest of it is your improvisation. So, you know, for me, what's the point? There are other people that is their passion, is playing things, jazz classically. Each song, a certain set that goes with not just the tune, but the style of the composer or performer. for me, if I can't find something in it totally personal or something I can smile at or something that I think will mess with the... I like a surreal feeling. You know, I'm from the 70s. I like to look at something and see something else instead, you know? So, and I like to hopefully give that same impression to the audience. So you're hearing a tune you've heard a million times, you're like, you know, huh, oh, anything, you know, putting it in a different way. And if I don't find that, I don't play it. However, the second part of your question is that I can be very, very faithful to the melody. It just depends on how I have surrealized the song. In the case of on the CD, Try to Remember, I think it's got a very faithful feeling. But I was trying to exude sort of a cloud, like a hypnotic feeling, you know. And then it came out with an ironic sort of joke at the end. And this is very much me. So that's, once it's me, then I really am excited to perform it or record it. But for there's a John Coltrane tune on the CD called 26-2, which I laughingly call 26-2-5. When I perform it, and so the melody is right, but because the surrealization is rhythmic in that one, the rhythm of the melody is different. So it really depends on the setting. I'll tell you, the closest analogy I can give in my treatment of my own tunes or standards is directors with movies. I much more relate to the idea that each tune becomes a movie. And once I feel like that, then I feel like we're presenting something more than just a musical interpretation. That's just within me. You know, sometimes when I think we've really gotten there, I'll turn to the musicians and say, well, that's a wrap. That was a movie. And the older I get, the more I do that, because my roots are really much more in watching movies than listening to music. Hmm. So, you know, once you embrace who you are, the music gets more personal and truly more creative. The more you deny who you are and try to validate yourself by the art form, the more recreative you are.
Hmm.
And it just depends on what kind of personality you have. I don't get turned on until I feel like I'm creating, and I don't get too turned on by recreating.
Hmm. I for one, absolutely love what you've done with Try to Remember, which even in its original form is one of my favorite songs. It's a favorite song of a lot of people, but I think what you've done with it is incredibly fresh and intriguing and really creates a kind of a haunting magic. I absolutely love it. As I listened to it, one of the first things that came to my mind was your very, very interesting, beguiling use of dissonance. And I wonder... In the kind of music that you create, do you even think very much about terms like dissonance and consonance, or in a sense, is that kind of a misnomer for a lot of what you create? I mean, to call any of it dissonance in kind of the musical dictionary sense of the word.
You know, it's funny. You ask very incisive questions, unusually perceptive, because you're... In all cases, you're touching on stuff that is a real thing with me. For example, I was on Mary McPartland's Piano Jazz a couple of times. And one time Downbeat they decided to take, I think, four pianists and sort of show their, you know, the text of what they had said on the shows. And there were many pianists, and I was honored that one of them they picked was mine. And I won't say who the other three were, but each one had their philosophy, and one of them was saying how the tradition, and this is what, you know, I my respect for this, and that, you know, it's funny, each one had a very different personality, and I think that's why they picked them. Then they get to mine, and, you know, they'll always pull out bylines, things on the page that from the article, but they're a little bigger, you know, whatever you call that. And so where this other guy's talking about tradition, this other one's talking about political, the other one's talking about Afro-American influence, and they get to mine, it says, The line they pulled out of it, there is no dissonance, there is no consonance. So, I mean, that's very much me. Again, if I think dissonance and consonance, I'm one step away from my actual inner sensual or sense connection to the music. I like what dissonance does to my, what you would call dissonance does to my head after a bunch of consonants. You know, my favorite food at the Chinese restaurant is sweet and sour.
Ah.
And as a person, I've always enjoyed sort of journeying from the bad boy place to the place of worship, and then I get bored with that, and then I kind of become a bad boy again. I've tempered that in later years. But I've always enjoyed the pleasure of opposites. And I like the way the dissonance feels after a lot of consonants, and when I have indulged in what you would call dissonance for a long time, it's really a relief for me to go completely into consonants. But rather than thinking that way, they're textures, you know? Like the touch on the skin. One kind of touch is rubbing, moving a hand lightly over just the hairs of your arm. Another touch is grabbing your arm. Another touch is tapping your arm. You know, to me, they're different textures, and that's why I can use them out of context. Because if I thought of them as dissonance, I guess I'm getting a little wrapped here, but if I thought of them as dissonance and consonants, then I would put them both in their traditional settings.
Right.
Something is consonant or something is dissonant. Or the contrast would be self-conscious. Hmm. You know you're mixing the consonant and dissonance to be clever. For me, they're just textures. For a moment, I'm going, and another moment, I'm going, ah! You know? And it's just that. I try to keep it as down in the cells as possible, you know, so that's a total connection that leaves, at least while performing. The mind takes a lot of, is there a lot when I'm working on an interpretation, because until I feel like it's gone down into this level that transcends the tune or whatever you're doing and puts out a vibe, you know, I don't want to perform it yet. So that takes a lot of thought or evolution. But performing for me is bypass. It's a, you know, you've heard of these bypasses, a mind bypass. Bypass the mind completely, you know. So it's just the touch of the keys on the fingers. And what happens is if you bypass the mind, instead of you creating music, the music whiffs into your head and it happens to you. So instead of me trying to fill the piano, I feel the piano filling me. And my job is just to go, yeah, yeah. You know, I brainwash myself that everything is yeah. Well, you know, I'm in my studio right now, so, you know, I can get, if I do this, yeah. But if I do this, yeah. You know what I mean? That way, there is no discrimination between consonants and dissonance.
Hmm. Let's enjoy now Kenny Werner's own rendition of Try to Remember, that great song from The Fantastics by Tom Jones and Harvey Schmidt. Again, this is the Kenny Werner Trio from the Pirouette album called The Melody.
Thank you.
That was Try to Remember by Tom Jones and Harvey Schmidt, given the unique treatment of pianist Kenny Werner. That was the Kenny Werner Trio from their Pirouette CD called The Melody. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Can you say a word about when you create music that is entirely original, that is not based on Try to Remember or 26-2 or anything else that's already in the world, but something that has literally begun with a blank page, and help us understand how your compositional process is tied up in the whole notion of improvisation. I mean, do you improvise these original compositions into being, or is the process not exactly that?
I have several processes. Sometimes I wait, and this hasn't happened in a long time, but sometimes I just wake up and there's a song there. And I try not to interfere with it. You know, I can start thinking about it and taking it through certain compositional processes, but if it's really that song that came from wherever, from beyond, it just dampens it to think it from there. Just take it as it is. And I have certain songs on older records, a tune like Guru or on the a record, I have one called Love, L-U-V, one called Shower Song, which was on a CD called Beauty Secrets. And you can tell these songs, I just received these whole songs. Actually, there's a funny one under the same category. One time I was staying with a great tennis sax player, Frank Tiberi. He was in Woody Herman's form in there for many years. And he's great. He's an influence on Joe Lovano and George Garzon, and he's a patron saint of those guys. And he happens to have hours and hours of live Coltrane in clubs that he recorded. And we sat there all night and listening to this stuff that no one's ever heard, or unless he played it for them. And I went to go to sleep in his living room, and instead of falling asleep, I heard a tune called Ballad for Train, which is on Joe Lovano's first Leader CD, Tone, Shapes, and Colors. Ballad for Train, and the thing came out in one swoop, and it's made up of really nothing but phrases of John Coltrane, because that's what I'd been hearing all night. Now, if they don't come to me that way, then I actually have a compositional process that's sort of relative to my playing process. When I play, I let my hands move, and I don't judge. When I write, I start putting notes down, and I don't judge. And then what I do is I start editing them to see what they might become. And I try to leave out deciding what it is for as long as possible.
Hmm.
So I have a progressive, you know, evolving process for composing, and I have a spontaneous process for composing, and I just take whichever one is coming. If nothing's coming spontaneously, I begin this evolving process. The similarity between the two processes and the way I play is I try to leave the judgment or the even analysis of what it is out until it almost writes itself, and I say, you know, wow, this, look at this material. Now it would be really weird if it was a samba, wouldn't it be? You know, I always tell my composition students, if you set out to write a samba, the bad news is you've written a samba. You know, and
one
and
more samba.
Yeah, right, as if we need another one, and as if anyone could write a better one than all the Brazilians that have written them. But the thing is, when you decide it's a samba in the beginning, it influences which chords you pick, what melodies you pick. It's all generic, and you're just adding a tune that nobody needs to hear. If you develop material, and then way later, you weren't thinking it at all, you said, if I made this a samba, it would sound different than every samba that I've ever heard, which, again, is what attracts me. So if you hear any of my jazz orchestra stuff, I have two CDs out, both with the Brussels Jazz Orchestra. One was called Naked in the Cosmos for a little Dutch label. I don't even know if you could find that. The other one is called Institute of Higher Learning, which is still available on Amazon and iTunes. You would hear my evolution-type composing process. These are long pieces that one thing develops into another. And on this Higher Learning CD, I have an arrangement of The House of the Rising Sun, if you remember that old pop tune. But here was the process. I sat down on the drums one day, and I don't play drums, but I was playing a pattern and hitting the bass drum with my foot in unusual displaced places. And then I got an idea. Wow, maybe I'll just write a piece just off of that bass drum thing. So So I got back to my computer, that's where I write, and I put that pattern in the bass trombone. So all I had first was boom, boom. You know, this thing happened in all different places. And I just started composing, and I was going and going and coming up with all kinds of things. I didn't know where it was going to go, what I was going to do. In the middle, and this happens to me a lot, in the middle of that kind of wild stuff, remember, sweet, sour, I'm hearing a quote from the House of the Rising Sun. So I quote it because it never came. I thought, how kinky. You know, we're in this place of, you should check it out sometime. You can find it on this, mm-hmm. the House of the Rising Sun. We're in this place with all these things moving around and very advanced rhythms. And it was that's a great band, the Brussels Jazz Orchestra, that can play it. And then all of a sudden you hear House of the Rising Sun. But then I quoted it again, and this is like I'm 50% into the piece, and I ask myself, are you actually writing an arrangement of the House of the Rising Sun? So I said, yeah, I think it would be better to call this the House of the Rising Sun than to quote it in the middle of some other kind of abstract piece. So, I mean, that's very typical of most of my long-form writing. And long-form writing for me generally was writing for big band or orchestra.
I know that people not only are excited about your concert tomorrow night, but also this masterclass that you're going to be leading. When you are working particularly with young musicians on, for instance, the art of improvisation, typically what is the most important lesson you're trying to share with them? Or are you not typically about those kind of abiding principles? Is it more about just responding to whatever they're sharing?
It can go any different way. Often what I have to offer that, again, is unique or unusual to other people is the stuff that I wrote in my book, which was called Effortless Mastery. And the whole idea there is that when you play from your mind, especially for a student, when a student plays from his mind, his thoughts are telling him, I'm not good enough. Thoughts are telling me, I should sound like this or else I'm not valid. His thoughts are telling me, why? These other people play better than me. You know, thoughts really mess people up at any level. And for students, it makes them overwhelmed. And so the message I try to come in is, let's learn to touch the instrument, not from your thoughts, but from what I call the space. And that's the space beyond the mind. Every religion and every philosophical path, and even in psychology circles, has a name for that stuff. But I just call it the space. And we know it exists. Everybody's had those moments in their life when something took over that was beyond what their mental, you know, beyond what their mind would have allowed them to do, even in battle, you know, let alone in music. And so I show them exercises for bypassing the mind and learning to touch the instrument from the space so that they can connect directly and not have all that thought block the connection. After a while, you know, if you come from the space, then touching your instruments like dipping your cold hands in warm water. If you come from your mind, sometimes it can be like touching a hot stove.
Wow.
So I kind of begin with that. And I say, I usually hook them in with this first sentence. I say, think about a time when you really needed to play well. How'd you play? What? You know, and they go, oh, terrible. Okay, I said, now think about a time when you're just messing around. It didn't matter. How'd you play? Everybody goes, oh, better. I said, wow, all right, the clinic could be over now, right? You just learned the most important lesson of your life. All this time you've been thinking, I'll just play better if I try harder. And now you just said by your own admission that trying harder makes you play worse. So I look at them all, I go, great, right? Now you're never going to try again, right? And they laugh. Because we're all so, humans are so remarkably similar in some ways, you know. And they laugh because even though they know that, they could play four bars and then they're trying again. And then we get into the fact that the mind forms patterns. Even though you now realize something's no good, you might be in the mental groove of doing it, you know. And then we talk about how do we change that program? How do we change that program from judging every note, which students will do increasingly, and older people definitely know what I'm talking about. How do we change that program from trying to get the music past the centurions at the gate, so to speak, your mind, and transform that into every note I play is the most beautiful sound I've ever heard. So the question is, which of those affirmations or deaffirmation, you know, which of those ideas will get us further? The idea that we have to come up to a certain standard, or the idea that every time we commit a note, it's the most beautiful sound we ever heard. You know, that's the general tenor of it, but it can take a different form. I'm a music theory nerd, so if someone says, you know, what's your harmonic thing, I might go into a whole other thing, because I developed kind of my own system for harmonic juxtaposition of things, again, just for color. So it could go anywhere, but usually, if I have one time with students, I'm thinking, what's the most valuable thing I can give them? Maybe I could help them get back in touch with their own sense of self, maybe their own heart, maybe their own creativity, or maybe just a little hope that they can find themselves through a certain process.
Wow. Kenny Werner comes with the Kenny Werner Trio, first of all, to lead a master class tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock in Francis Bedford Hall, and then takes the stage himself with the Kenny Werner Trio tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m., a concert at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And if you would like information about tickets, you can call their box office, 262-595-2564, or visit uwp.edu/the-rita to get more information. This is a concert proudly presented by the Kenosha Community Foundation. Kenny Werner, what a pleasure and honor for me to speak with you today. And I know so many people are excited about you coming to town, and we wish you a wonderful visit here in Kenosha, and nothing but more success as your career continues. And thank you for being a part of the morning show today.
Sure. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear the conversation which I recorded with one of the country's most highly regarded composers of art song and modern opera. His name is Jake Heggie, and a really beautiful and poignant work of his called Three Decembers is being performed right now at the Milwaukee Florentine Opera. In it, it tells the story of a woman and her two children and their get-togethers on three different Christmases a decade apart. And the through line, among other things, in addition to kind of the difficulties and awkwardness of this family, is also the various phases of the AIDS crisis, which is impacting each of them in various ways. Three Decembers opened last weekend to great acclaim, and there are performances this weekend as well. And you'll hear my conversation with composer Jake Heggie on tomorrow's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. We are under a high wind warning now until 8 o'clock tonight. Our wind gusts will be all the way up to 55 miles per hour, and rain showers are expected intermittently all day long, a high of 53 degrees. Cloudy tonight, continued windy and cool, a low of 38 degrees. Cloudy with a 40% chance of rain, a high of 46 degrees, not quite as windy as today. Friday will be partly sunny, still